This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 27th, 2016. I'm Caleb Brown. What would a proper audit of the Federal Reserve look like? And what should we expect from a Fed during the Trump administration? Jim Grant publishes Grant's Interest Rate Observer. He spoke at the Cato Institute's Monetary Conference in November.
The best line in the election, there are two great lines in the election. One is, only he could lose to her, and only she could lose to him. That was from a Wall Street Journal editorial in the spring, and that's how true that was. The second great line was one uttered by David Gelernter, who was a Yale computer science professor, a polymath of great genius. Don't throw that word around. He's a very, very accomplished man in many fields. He wrote a piece of the Wall Street Journal propounding the view that Donald Trump is the better alternative. And he said, quote, "Donald Trump is the empty gin bottle of the people's wrath." And yeah, close quote. And to me, that line is so clarifying. It's funny and it's winning, but it speaks to the nature of the election, the nature of the mood of the country, and it speaks as well to I think to the true legacy of our recent monetary methods. The economy can't seem to swing its legs out of bed in the morning. 2% as measured, people feel as if they haven't got much of a future. And I'm not sure all this can be laid at the doorstep of the Fed. In fact, I'm quite sure all of it cannot be. And people have been throwing brickbats at central banks for as long as central banks have existed. But when you have a once in 5,000 year occurrence, you know something is new. And I refer to interest rates pitched to levels of less than zero. That has not happened in the recorded history of interest rates, which is a 5,000-year narrative. That's new. And when something is really, really new under the sun of finance, which is a rarity, one is beckoned to stop and take notice.
All right. So what brought us here?
Bad ideas brought us here. In particular, the overarching bad idea is that of statism, and the subheading must be something to do with the nature of money, it being a public good, something to do with the responsibility of the government for forestalling business cycle downturns, and the bad idea that somehow economists in their expert knowledge can see into the future and improve it before it comes to pass. All those bad ideas conspired to bring us to where we are. It is a there's a wonderful physicist named Richard Feynman of yesteryear. He was a Nobel Prize winner and a little bit like David Gelernter, a polymath. Feynman was very funny, very witty, and very knowing about the human condition quite outside of the realm of physics. And he gave a commencement talk to the Caltech class in 1974. He said, you know, I used to think that we lived in an age of science. And then I came out to California and I see all these people believing in ESP and astrology. And I think we live in the age of pseudoscience. And he said, I especially think that, having reflected on the pedagogy, the higher schools of pedagogy. They teach teachers new methods of educational theory. And these are very finely developed bodies of knowledge, except I can't help but notice that the test scores in the schools are getting lower, not higher. So I call this pseudoscience. I call it cargo cult science, he said, because am I boring you with this? No. So in the Second World War, there was an island heretofore unexplored on which the Army Air Forces made a base. They landed planes. The planes disgorged cargo that was wondrous to the native peoples who had never before seen a plane or anything to do with the 20th century. And at length, the war was won. The army left. Planes didn't come anymore. The people on the island wished the planes would return. So to make them return, they made runways. They lit the runways with torches. They set up a control tower. They gave the controller bamboo headphones, and they waited. Planes didn't come. So Feynman told the Caltech graduates that that was the point. They recreated the methods of science, the evident rigmarole of science, but without the substantive thing. And isn't that monetary economics? The economic planes don't land. The theory was that the Fed was going to raise up asset prices, lift up stock prices, lift up real estate values, and people feeling richer because of their portfolios would spend. That spending would ignite other activity, and before long, we would be back in clover. Well, those planes haven't landed. But what hasn't happened is nobody named Richard Feynman or first approximation to that in the year 2016. Nobody has come out and said, this is a pseudo-scientific undertaking. These 700 PhDs in the staff of the Fed, these aspirational physicists, they ought to go work for the Navy Department, they ought to go work for NASA, any place except this institution of money. But nobody's listening.
So
Ron Paul, in his two campaigns for president, most recently made a big deal out of auditing the Fed. What would that look like to your satisfaction?
I would think that a meaningful audit of the Fed would be one in which the Fed explains itself, and it must explain itself to the layman in plain, intelligible English. No more of these footnotes garlanded with algebra and differential calculus. What we want is not the econometricians talking to other econometricians. We want the econometricians being forced to explain themselves in the language of the taxpayer. And they would have to tell us why the Fed exists. They would have to tell us why administered prices, as in the stock market and the bond market, why administered prices are superior to prices that are discovered in the free play of market forces. They would have to tell us why, notwithstanding the elaborate dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models that were deployed in the early 2000s, that the economists at the Fed missed the biggest professional event of their lives in 2008. How'd that happen? And I guess these questions appear from time to time in Humphrey Hawkins' testimony and other appearances on the Hill by the Fed C-suite. But I somehow think that the answers get lost. And I think I think an audit to be, I mean, the GAO goes in and counts up pencils and, I guess, Federal Reserve notes.
Auditing the books, not the process.
And the books ought to be audited. I mean, this is it's a $4.5 trillion operation. It's no small potatoes. Yes, audit the books. Count the gold in the elsewhere, and that's outside the Fed now. But count the gold. Audit the books. I think more important is to let us all rethink this outfit. This outfit is insulated from operational competition by the law. It is insulated by intellectual competition from the tenure rules prevailing at university economics faculties. It's undisruptible. Well, let an audit begin to disrupt it.
All right. So we talked about the prohibitions on competition. What might operational competition look like in a way that is, let's say, minimally disruptive in the short run?
Well, let's lift taxes on gold such that you don't pay a collectibles tax for switching what is stamped in the case of U.S. gold coins, stamped as money. You don't pay a tax as if it were not money. Let's not tax money. Let's tax Federal Reserve notes. Let's equilibrate legacy money contemporary money. Let us do that through the tax system. And that's not going to work any miracles. But what it will allow is people to experiment this. Entrepreneurs will start as they've already begun, but they're working against very difficult tax conditions. Let entrepreneurs start alternative currency regimes. Now, I think that finally there will be one currency regime because money is a unit of measurement. We don't have different units of measurement for industrial specifications. The world would be a chaos if we did. We need a homogeneous and universally accepted set of monetary values, but maybe we should introduce a competition to find which one the people want more. The people have one only by law. Let's put a little fresh wind through.
Do you have any thoughts on what those competitive currencies might be or what they might look like?
Yes, I do. The The symbol in the periodic table of the elements is AU. I'm a gold guy. Silver, too, sometimes. But I believe that the gold standard, as it evolved for the better part of 100 years, more than that certainly in more primitive forms, but as it evolved in connection with the institution of fractional reserve banking, that particular mix of money and banking was, you know, the flywheel of the Industrial Revolution. It had its most imperfect system, as all human contrivances are. But it strikes me as far superior to anything that has been tried since. And don't take my word for it. Read a book by a guy named Arthur Bloomfield, who worked for the New York Fed, who wrote, I think, in 1958, a monograph about the classical gold standard, 1880 to 1914, and in spite of himself, concluded it was a pretty fine system. Very fine system.
So in relation to that, you said you're a gold guy and that the Federal Reserve should be compelled to explain itself to people who are not econometricians. Should one of the things that they have to explain be persistent inflation for 100 plus years?
Sure. They have to answer
not just that, but the moral preferability of persistent inflation.
They have to explain why a 2% per annum upcreep in the price level is on its face desirable. And this is, and one of the maddening things about the mandarins at the Fed is they come up with these things and they regard them as self-evident. And if you don't speak their language in rebuttal, they won't even listen to your rebuttal. It takes a model to beat a model, quoth Ben S. Bernanke, Ph.D. Well, nuts. There is a common sense objection to losing 2% a year on the money you earn, right? It's like somebody was taking away from you. In fact, there was a most eloquent president of the Atlanta Fed named, I think, Malcolm Bryan, who in the 1960s wrote the most emotionally laden screeds against even the intimation of inflation, which these began to see in the early 1960s. So we've gone from that to the institutionalization of inflation without really any public debate. I mean, I think people are of at least two minds on this inflation question. So many millions of Americans haven't had a raise in years or decades. So many feel the tug of this latent deflationary force having to do with, I think, the cause of which is the overencumbrance of everything in the economy. It's debt. And it is global competition. And it is a lack of dynamism that comes from, among other things, from a very, very slow rate of population growth. I think the birth control pill is some distant cause, remote cause of what is happening now in the way of economic growth or its lack. You know, people are getting married later, forming families later. People have two kids rather than three or four. Pretty soon, the birth rate is 0.8, and people say, "Well, why is productivity growth so? Why is growth so low? Why?" Well, it's a kind of a tired society that doesn't reproduce itself. It's especially tired in Japan. It's especially tired in Italy, but in America is looking a little fatigued too. So everything cannot be laid at the doorstep of our monetary manipulators. But
ought to be. To the extent that the birth control pill was a piece of technology that gave women more control over their lives, that's something that wasn't built into models.
It was not. And people prefer this. I mean, a lot of people prefer fiat money, and they have their reasons, and those reasons are wholly defensible. And many women have enjoyed the freedom that comes from their choice not to have to be the rock and foundation of a family of 12. That is, in many people's view, an element of progress in the world. But we have to face the fact that the previous time the Cubs won the World Series was the year 1908. And I happen to know this because, first of all, I was alive then and a fan. But population was growing at 1.8% a year, and in that year of 1908, and something like a million plus immigrants, gross, not net, because some left, came into the country, which is the equivalent of like 3 or 4 million today. It's a huge influx of people. So the country was bursting at its seams. As technology was exploding, most constructively. The internal combustion engine was to the fore. My goodness, you could walk into a house, turn the lights on, inside plumbing. What next? So all these things were happening at once, along with a huge burst of demographic growth and a gold standard. The country was, in relative terms, impoverished compared to today. Top Cubs players were making $3,000 a year. The salary of the Cubs today was $170 million, $160 million for the whole... Wow, so that's a huge accretion of wealth over the years. So fiat money has not stood in the way of our getting richer and our getting, I suppose, much more technically advanced. You know, it's been a wondrous 100 years under the Fed. How much more wondrous might it have been except for the spoliation, I say, of our money through these manipulations? And I think we can have all things. We can have technology, we can have liberty, we can have free trade, and we can have sound money.
To what extent does the Federal Reserve chairman, something that the president, our new president, Donald Trump, will have some say over, how much can that impact the functioning of the Federal Reserve and how they do their business? And to the extent you want to move toward a world of something, a more robust monetary system that can withstand bigger shocks, what does the head of the agency, how does that impact how
well,
we get there?
The head of the chairman of the Federal Reserve has a vote and also has great moral authority over other voters. However, that person is not a dictator. And it might just be that the incoming chairman of the Federal Reserve System, succeeding Janet Yellen in 2018, let us say, that new chairman becomes a pariah in the eyes of the administration of the Fed, of the staff of the Fed, of the other governors, and of the Reserve Bank presidents. These are loyalists to an institution. So I don't think that the new chairman is going to work any miracles of reform. And I think also that the new chairman ought to be careful lest he or she receive a kind of a poison chalice. I mean, I think there is a comeuppance due to us, not for necessarily for sins we have committed, but for choices we have made in money and in debt. The stock market is at or near a record high in level. It's at a record high in level. It is quite up there in valuation. Real estate values are extended, especially in commercial real estate. Bond prices until very recently were at heights never before seen, let alone or even imagined. So who's to say there's not going to be some reversion to the mean in financial markets, which could be a very noisy and ugly one? Donald Trump, in one of his more lucid moments in the campaign trail, talked about a big, fat, ugly bubble. Well, to many on Wall Street, it's a quite beautiful bubble. It's been a great cornucopia, to change the metaphor. But the trouble with really, really expensive markets is that they don't get forever more expensive. They revert to a level that is much more in the way of an average. And by way of returning to the average, they become very cheap. So that's the way markets work. They are cyclical. They move up and they move down. If they move up a lot, there'll be a correction. And what the errors the correction will correct are the errors of excessive lending and borrowing, of reckless extension of credit. They will correct the errors of misallocation of capital that perhaps come from of mispriced interest, fixed interest rates not discovered in the market but administered from on high. They'll fix that error as well. So corrections correct error. And errors come in clumps when prices are administered. So if I were the prospective new Fed chairman or governor, I'd be very careful about owning the problems that preceded my arrival on the premises. There are a lot of good people who could do that job, by the way. I'm going to put in a plug for my pal Judy Shelton, who is no stranger to the Cato Institution, but she would make a great successor to Janet Yellen.
Jim Grant publishes Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Google Play, and with Cato's iOS app. And follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.